Previously on Beta.
Hello, I'm Mr. Red.
I'm a dreamer, but the dreams are always visions. So I'm a visionary more than I'm a dreamer.
With the smell of blood in the air, I'm suddenly surrounded by ravenous, drooling jaws.
Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Today, poet and critic Hanif Abdurraqib makes the case for one of the most influential rap groups ever, A Tribe Called Quest.
For me, my own personal relationship with them, their legacy is one of a handful of groups that showed me there are infinite ways to look at the world, be curious about the world, and create in the world.
Also, filmmaker Jeannie Finley on embedding in the very private production of Game of Thrones for her HBO documentary, The Last Watch.
So I sat down with David and Dan and I just sort of said, I'm not going to ask you for a lot, but when I do come and ask you for stuff, you need to listen. And I said, you've got to let me film the table read. You have to. Just trust me. It'll be great.
What you're saying is, everything is society's fault, and we as individuals never need to take responsibility for anything.
No, not exactly. I was just saying
yeah,
that...
I like that. I didn't do anything wrong because I can't do anything wrong. Because we're all just products of our environment, bouncing around like marbles in the game of Hungry Hungry Hippos that is our random and cruel universe.
That's a clip from the hit animated Netflix series BoJack Horseman. It's the story of a washed-up, depressed sitcom star in his 50s, who also happens to be a horse. Raphael Bob Waksberg is the creator of BoJack Horseman, and he's also the author of a short story collection called Someone Who Will Love You in All Your Damaged Glory. Like BoJack, Raphael's stories find a great balance of melancholy and humanity and love.
I have a poem in my new book that is a story about a guy who writes a poem for a girl he's dating. And that was also based on a different experience, actually, where I wrote a poem for a girl and it felt inappropriate. I'll say it was more for me than it was for her.
I see.
And as soon as I gave it to her, that kind of became clear and it was very uncomfortable. And so the poem in the book is a heavily fictionalized version of that event.
I see. Would you mind reading an excerpt from the poem?
Sure, I'd be happy to. I'm more than a little ambivalent over expressions of tender devotion. This one day a year because greeting card companies profit off store-bought emotion. A romance industrial complex so fueled by commodification of feeling serves only to further homogenize all and promote what's at best unrevealing. It's not just a lack of precision, this one-size-fits-allness that leads me to mope. I think you and I share the same disillusionment, sprouted from long-buried hope. I worry, as you do, love dulls us to cold hollow sockets that ache for a joint. If ends are encoded in every beginning, we wonder, then what is the point? You're right to be highly suspicious of seemingly mandated acts of affection, when all pretty words are a means to an ultimate heartbreak, a grand misdirection. I can't guarantee that this letter won't lead to us both one day broken and blue. All that being said, though, you turn me to mush. Happy Valentine's, Wendy, to you. As Wendy regarded the card she received with a coolness that trended toward frozen, Fernando now briefly considered he'd gone a bit wrong with the words he had chosen. He'd wanted to offer assurance to Wendy that all her concerns were well-founded, while also affirming he wasn't afraid of the many alarm bells she'd sounded. "Hey, don't fall in love with me," Wendy had said, and Fernando insisted, "I'm not." He thought he had threaded the needle quite well, but it seemed not as well as he'd thought. "You turn me to mush" was perhaps a bit much. Yes, in hindsight, his error was here. The poem's detachment undone in an instant by something so baldly sincere.
That was great. Thank you. I love that surprise that you create with this pivot in the fourth stanza, because it starts out as a poem, but then it pivots to a short story about the writing of the poem.
Right, while continuing to be a poem.
Exactly. Did you have this idea from the very beginning, or did that kind of come up while you were writing it?
Yeah, well, it started as the poem itself, and then I kept thinking about what this poem was and what it meant and represented, and the story kind of flowed from there and continued. I mean, one thing I try to do in all my stories is justify the form with the content. So a lot of times I'll think of the form first of like, oh, I want to tell a story like this or in this kind of style. I really wanted to do a story in verse. You know, I'm a big fan of David Rakoff's book, Love, Dishonor, Marry, Die, Cherish, Perish, which is an entire book written in verse. And I always enjoy writing little poems and here and there. And so I thought, could I write a whole story that was a poem? And so then I thought, well, what would justify a story being a poem? And then I thought, well, if it's about a poem, that feels like a good place to start.
Yeah, for sure. You've got kind of a Marshall McLuhan medium is the message thing going on there.
Right, exactly.
Back in 2010, when you first came up with the idea for BoJack Horseman, you wrote that you envisioned the tone of the show as darkly funny with a melancholy Great Gatsby-ish center. Would you say that this description fits your short story collection?
Yes, I think that's true. I think that depending on your own emotional constitution, you might find the stories in this book to be very funny, or you might find them to be very sad. And I've seen both that reaction, which I think is very interesting, that they are, I think, funny mostly, but there's a dark comedy to them, and there certainly is a melancholy center to a lot of them.
Yeah, which also reminds me of the new review of your book. The AV Club describes you as one of the most consistent and efficient purveyors of transcendent tragic comedy. Do you think of your work as tragic comic? It sounds like you do.
I guess so. Yeah. I don't know if I'd call it transcendent, but I'm very flattered to be described in those terms.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think that tragedy and comedy, that's life, right? It's all kind of funny and sad. And the way we muddle through it can be inspiring and devastating and hilarious and stupid. And I kind of want to track that gamut in my work. I think that real life has all of those modes. It's a sweet and salty mix of all of it. And that's something that I definitely try to convey in my work.
Yeah, which you do very well, I think. Let's talk a bit about the story, A Most Blessed and Auspicious Occasion. Can you tell me a bit about this one without revealing any spoilers?
Sure. This story is maybe one of the more autobiographical in the book.
Really?
Well, it's based on my wedding, mm-hmm. Although very loosely based. You know, when my wife and I decided to get married, we decided early on we wanted to keep it very small and very simple. And I was really continually shocked in the planning of the wedding, how even trying to keep it small and simple, how it became quite an ordeal. And, you know, how all the people we had to please and all the things we had to do. Also to please ourselves based on our own expectations of what a wedding was and needed to be. And how even this very small version of it ended up being quite overwhelming, but in the end, quite beautiful as well.
Now would be a great time to have you read an excerpt.
Sure. Really, the only thing stressing me out is the goats thing, says Dorothy. Once we figure out what to do with the goats, everything else falls into place. All of a sudden, I have a crazy idea. So crazy, I feel like I can't even say it out loud, but as soon as it worms its way into my head, I feel like I can't not say it, so I blurt out, "You want to just not sacrifice any goats?" Dorothy is silent for a moment, and I know that as soon as I stop the car, she's going to get out and run away and never talk to me again, and the next time I see her is going to be in a photo on the cover of a trashy tabloid at the checkout line with the headline, "My fiancé didn't want to sacrifice goats." But instead, Dorothy says, "Can we do that?" And I say, "Dorothy, it's our wedding. We can do whatever we want." She smiles, and I feel like how Clark Kent must feel when he overhears someone talking about Superman. But doing whatever we want turns out to be a real headache when we're applying for our marriage license. "How many goats are you going to sacrifice to the stone god?" asks the woman at window 5. "We're not going to sacrifice any goats to the stone god," I say proudly. "It's not that kind of wedding." The woman looks down at her form and then back up at us. "So, just like 5 then?" "No," says Dorothy. "0. The man behind us in line groans and makes a big show out of looking at his watch. "I don't understand," says the woman. "You mean like 1 or 2? The stone god is not going to like getting so few goats." "No," I say, "not 1 or 2. 0. We are sacrificing 0 goats to the stone god." She crinkles up her nose. "Well, there's not an option on the form for 0, so I'm just going to put you down for 5. Next thing I know, we get a visit from Dorothy's best friend, Nikki. "I heard you're only going to sacrifice 5 goats." "No," I start to say, but she cuts me off. "If you don't sacrifice at least 38 goats, my mom's not going to come. You know she's a traditionalist about this sort of thing."
That was awesome. Great energy, flow, and pace in your reading, and I love the voice of the woman.
Thank you.
So you mentioned that this story is loosely based on your own wedding, but
very loosely,
because there were no goats sacrificed.
Yes, I want to be very clear. There were no goats sacrificed at our wedding.
So it seems to me like you're really taking on the wedding industrial complex with this story about how they try and monetize a wedding and, you know, that the more money you spend, the more happy right. and successful your wedding is going to be. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's the wedding industry, but there's also the wedding culture. You know, it's so ingrained in kind of the what we imagined for ourselves ever since we were little kids of what our wedding would be like and what the perfect wedding is and what it means and what it represents. I think that means something a little different to everybody, but it's all kind of wrapped around this cultural ideal based on the culture that we swim in.
Yeah. So did you have a big wedding?
No, we still kept it pretty small. But even keeping it small, there were a lot of decisions to be made and a lot of things that we wanted to be just perfect.
I want to ask you about the story Rufus, or Rufus is how it should be pronounced, right? Is that what that why it's written that way with
yes.
the big letters at the end? Yeah, Rufus.
Yes.
So this story yeah. is told entirely from the point of view of a dog named Rufus. What inspired you to write this story?
I was walking my dog, which I got when I married my wife. She came with a dog. And I'd never really been a pet person before this. I didn't have pets growing up. I never really got dogs, I'll say. My friends would have dogs. And it kind of became a running joke with my friends that I was very uncomfortable around them or didn't quite know how to be around them or how to treat them. And then I started taking care of first my girlfriend's dog, and then it became my wife's dog. And now he's my dog as well. And I really fell in love with him and became delighted by him. And I was really fascinated in his understanding of me and my role in his life. And I felt like a lot of the fictional representations of dogs I'd seen had either been very stupid or all-knowing, kind of like, oh, you know, my master doesn't understand that he's in love with this person, but I'm going to, you know, wrap my leash around them and get them together or whatever. And I felt like neither was quite true of my dog. And I felt like my dog was very smart, but just his context was completely different than mine. And I tried to imagine what the world would look like through my dog's understanding of it. And that was kind of the beginning of Rufus.
Could you read the opening from Rufus for us?
Sure. Rufus is a noise that has many meanings. Sometimes, when man-monster makes noise like Rufus, what it means is, come here. Sometimes, Rufus means, I am currently petting your head. Sometimes, Rufus means, I am happy to see you. And sometimes it means, I am very upset. I have discerned many meanings of noise Rufus. I am very smart. Occasionally, man-monster is making noises with other man-monster, and in middle of many annoying nonsense noises, man-monster will make noise Rufus, and I will look at man-monster like, why did you make noise Rufus? And man-monster will see me looking and will laugh. I do not know why this delights man-monster so, but I am happy to delight. Man-monster makes many noises, and part of my job as companion to man-monster is to decipher noises and discern meanings. At first, I did not care to discern meanings of man-monster noises, because why should I bother? I am creature with rich interior life. I should waste time trying to discern meanings of grunts and whines from man-monster? But now I see that man-monster is very unable to discern meanings of my noises, so if we are to understand each other at all, I am the one who must discern meanings. And since we live in same house, it is better for everyone if someone understands someone. So, fine. We are companions, and I discern meanings. Here is example. When man-monster is upset, man-monster makes noise like, bad dog! This is worst noise man-monster can make. Bad dog is for when universe conspires to make life miserable, and one is without hope. Many times, man-monster is very frustrated at situation, and makes bad dog at me, like is my fault universe is unfair. This is very frightening for me to see man-monster agitated so, when I am so small. But I know man-monster is foolish beast, and does not know is not my fault for bad dog.
That was good. I love how you
Thank
said
you.
Bad dog. Bad dog! Back in 2010, when you first came up with the idea for BoJack Horseman, you described BoJack as insufferably self-deprecating, neurotic, abrasive, and stubborn. Larry David meets Bender from Futurama. I love that description. I'm wondering, is there a particular character that you can point to in your book as being the most like BoJack?
I don't think my characters in the book are like BoJack at all very much. You know, I think I really kind of got my BoJack kicks out on the show. And I was interested in exploring other worlds in the books, although I will say there is a strain of melancholy that kind of, you know, lives in the veins of BoJack, the current of his life.
You're a millionaire movie star with a girlfriend who loves you, acting in your dream movie. What more do you want? What else could the universe possibly owe you?
I want to feel good about myself. The way you do. And I don't know how.
And I think that strain of melancholy certainly exists in a lot of the characters in the book. There's a story called Move Across the Country, which is about a character trying to outpace their own depression by picking up their roots and moving around. And I think that is very BoJack-y, that idea of I'm miserable here, but maybe if I go somewhere else, I can be less miserable, and that misery kind of following you. So I certainly think there's a strain of BoJack that kind of pervades a lot of these.
Raphael Bob Waksberg is the creator of the animated Netflix series BoJack Horseman. He's also the author of the short story collection, Someone Who Will Love You in All Your Damaged Glory. You can find out more about Raphael at WPR.org/beta.
Because Tribe was using these instrumental bass lines that were really heavy and deep and bottomed out, that also sounded good in the car.
Critic Hanif Abdurraqib on the low-end musical magic of A Tribe Called Quest. That's coming up in just a moment. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio. Hanif Abdurraqib is an acclaimed poet and cultural critic. He's also a big fan of A Tribe Called Quest, the groundbreaking hip-hop collective that formed in 1985. Hanif's the author of a book called Go Ahead in the Rain, Notes to A Tribe Called Quest. The book is a love letter to a group, a sound, and an era.
Okay, so guitar.
I distinctly remember watching the music video for I Left My Wallet in El Segundo shortly after it dropped, and I had to be around 8 or 9 years old, maybe 10. So I didn't buy any albums on my own until, you know, I was a teenager.
Right.
But I think when Low End Theory came out, it got played in our house a lot because my parents were not that into us having rap in the house until the Low End Theory came around, and because of the jazz influences and because those sounds were perhaps bringing up some nostalgic memories or nostalgic feelings for my parents, my older brother was kind of able to play Low End Theory really loud in the house without headphones, and so I gained an affection for Low End Theory through that.
I see, yeah, and this was the band's second album, released in 1991, and as you mentioned, this is the album when they really started showing the influence of jazz on their work, right?
Right, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. The opening song on the Low End Theory is called Excursions. Can you tell me a bit about this song?
Yeah, I mean, Excursions is, I think, one of the great opening tracks in, you know, maybe music history. One of the great track one, side ones.
Back in the days when I was a teenager, before I had status and before I had a pager, you can find the abstract, listening to hip-hop. My pops used to say it reminded him of bebop. I said, well, daddy, don't you know that things go in cycles? Way the Bobby Brown is just amping like Michael. It's all expected. Things are for the looking. If you got the money, Quest is for the booking.
It utilizes like an Art Blakey sample. Shades of Brown sample, and of course the some vocals from The Last Poets. And I think as an entry point, Excursions is such a great song because it so distinctly shows that you are getting a different group than the group you left. Right? They were a different group than the last album. And to be clear, I mean, these albums didn't come out that far from each other.
That's true, right? Yeah. Yeah, and you say that Excursions is the first rap song you knew that could sound good in almost any situation. What do you mean?
Well, I heard it in the house on speakers. I heard it in the car. I heard it on headphones. You know, I listened to it on the way to school on my headphones. And so it was one of those songs I thought transferred settings really well, where, you know, coming up, and especially in the summertime, folks would be looking for songs that sounded good in a car, you know, like heavy bass tracks that mm-hmm. kind of rattle the trunk a bit. But because Tribe was using actual bass lines, you know, like either sampled or played by Ron Carter, like these instrumental bass lines that were really heavy and deep and bottomed out, that also sounded good in the car. It sounded good in the car in a different kind of way, you know. You know, music history does not begin where I think many people think it begins, and very few artists are the first to do something, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think A Tribe Called Quest understood the history of jazz music, and they understood the history of blues music, and they also understood, it seemed to me, that rock and roll music is a product of American blues, right?
Yeah.
And so they were borrowing from ancestors, but also honoring that borrowing by understanding that they were not the first to attempt the type of sounds they were going for. Stern, firm, and young with a laid-back
tongue. The aim is to succeed and achieve at 21. Just like, what do you think drew the members of A Tribe Called Quest to the sounds of classic jazz?
I think the reason I liked them is that their music sounded like they maybe came from homes that similar to the one I came from. You know, I came from a home where music was always playing. And I think when you come from a place where music is always playing, you're kind of building a catalog of sounds you love, whether or not you even realize it's happening, you know,
mm-hmm.
until you set out to make your own sounds.
What do you think drew the members of A Tribe Called Quest to each other, together, to form the group?
Well, they were childhood friends, right? I mean, yeah. I think that you kind of create from there.
Yeah.
You know, I think we all had a crew that, when I was young, I had a crew I rolled with. And, you know, you find the right crew, and that crew is going to be down for whatever.
The Low End Theory album established the vocal interplay between Q-Tip and Fife Dog. How important was this, that the vocal interplay between the two, to the development of the group's sound?
Well, not only the vocal interplay, but I think the tonal interplay and mm-hmm. the moods, the different moods they bought. You know, A Tribe Called Quest could not just be Q-Tip, although, I mean, obviously Q-Tip is an immense talent, but I think it also needed the levity of Fife Dog and the unique, sharp wit of Fife Dog to really balance out the group's overall mood. You know, what I like about Low End Theory is that it's kind of the album where we get Fife. And so I love bugging out, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yo, microphone check, 1, 2, what is this? The 5 foot assassin with the roughneck business. I float like gravity, never had a cavity. Got more rhymes than the one that's got family. No need to sweat Arsenios to gain some type of fame. No shame in my game, cause I always be the same. Styles upon styles upon styles is what I have. You wanna just the Fifer, but you still don't know the half. I love Check the Rhyme.
Yeah. But then grab the microphone and let your words rip. Now here's a funky introduction of how nice I am. Tell your mother, tell your father, send a telegram. I'm like an energizer cause you see I last long. My crew is never ever whack because we stand strong. Now if you say my style is whack, that's where you're dead wrong. I slay that body and El Segundo, then push it along. And I, of course, there are many crew cuts of Force and Arrow, but for me, I got introduced to what a crew cut could be by listening to Scenario. So here's bust the rhymes with the scenario. Watch as I combine all the juice from the mind. Heal up, wheel up, bring it back, come rewind. Powerful impact, boom, from the cannon. Now bragging, try to reap a mind. Just imagine, both can't build, there is necessary. When digging into my library, oh my gosh, oh my gosh. Eating, I do still like the one pizza tosser. All over the track, man. As I come back. How did fans and critics respond to the Low End Theory album?
Oh,
the Low End Theory is one of the most critically acclaimed albums of all time, not just in the genre of hip-hop, but, you know, retrospectively, it's seen as more boundary-pushing and groundbreaking as time goes on.
Wow, so that shows just how far ahead the group was.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Far ahead of their time, yeah. So A Tribe Called Quest is now a known quantity thanks to the success of the Low End Theory. And then the band releases its third album, Midnight Marauders, in 1993.
Hello, this is your Midnight Marauder program.
You say that this is the album on which Q-Tip and Fife were most tuned in to each other's needs and desires. How so?
Yeah, it seemed like, you know, Fife wasn't really on the first album much at all.
Mm-hmm.
And on the second album, it seemed like Fife was a member of the group who was figuring out his role within the group and still in some ways a bit tentative. But on Midnight Marauders, it felt like they were more of a group than they'd ever been. Fife was comfortable and Q-Tip had figured out how to play off of him. It seemed like their styles were bouncing off each other instead of being somewhat lyrically at odds.
Linden Boulevard, represent, Zen Tribe Called Quest, represent, Zen. The mic is in my hand, I'm never hesitant. My favorite jam back in the day was Eric B for president. Queens is in the house, represent, Zen. A Tribe Called Quest, represent.
Yeah. Do you have a favorite song on Midnight Marauders that it illustrates how they were kind of playing and bouncing off of each other?
Yeah, I mean, Midnight Marauders is my favorite Tribe album, I think.
Oh.
And, you know, so it's hard for me to pick just one.
Yeah.
I think We Can Get Down mm-hmm. is probably up there. I can kick a rhyme over ill drum rolls with the kick, snare, kicks and hi-hat. Lyrics to Go is, of course, a classic. Those two, I think, are good examples of the lyrical content. No one can seem to beat it. Pull out your microphone
and watch the Fife or make you eat it. The MCs, they get you. Yeah. Q-Tip and Fife Dawg grew up together in Queens. How did their working relationship evolve over the remainder of the group's career, like post-Midnight Marauders?
Well, I mean, I think it became a bit tenuous, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which is kind of to be understood if you have a career that is tied to a person and you grew up with them and you've been friends for a long time and you've had experiences with them that go beyond what the public knows.
Yeah. There was this documentary called Beats, Rhymes, and Life, The Travels of a Tribe Called Quest that came out in 2011, I think. And you say the documentary is mainly about friendship, but mostly it's about a friendship that's no longer working.
Right. You know, it's heartbreaking in a lot of ways. I don't think anyone would want to have a life, an almost lifelong friendship documented during a tough moment.
I've known Q-Tip since we were about 2 years old.
We met in church. Best friends, you know what I'm saying? He was the one who said to me, yo, you should rhyme. And if you could rhyme, that was like a big deal.
Then he met Ali in high school, and before you knew it, it was on.
You had one voice that was high.
A little high-pitched voice. I hated my voice.
And then you had Tip, who was like in the middle.
And that was always a dynamic.
The yin and yang of those two, that to me was the perfect marriage.
It's just very hard, I think, to be a public figure and love someone for a long time.
Yeah. Fife died of complications related to diabetes in March 2016. He was only 45. How did you react when you heard the news?
I was really heartbroken. You know, Fife was kind of my guy.
Yeah.
And
why? Why was he kind of your guy?
Fife was short. I'm short. Mm-hmm. Fife was witty and sharp and kind of quick-tongued, and I thought I was similar in some ways.
Yeah.
So it was the first time I thought I saw myself, you know, reflected in a rapper. You know, when mm-hmm. I was coming up, rappers largely were extremely cool. And Fife was cool in a different way. Fife was, you know, cool in the kind of way that I thought I could be cool.
Yeah.
He had a wealth of popular culture knowledge that he could deploy at a moment's notice. So I was heartbroken when Fife died because Fife was maybe the first time in my life as a rap fan that I felt I could see some path to my own coolness represented.
That's very touching. Was it Fife's death that inspired you to write the personal letters to the members of A Tribe Called Quest that are featured in your book?
I did not write this book assuming that any of them would read it. And so I wanted to have some level of personal closeness
mm-hmm.
that did not require a response.
Yeah.
The chapters that those letters are in are chapters that express my grief or my curiosities, knowing that they don't have to respond.
Yeah, it really works well because it kind of gets at the essence of fandom, of especially music fandom, how we have these personal relationships, the way we identify with our musical heroes. So it worked really well. The group's final album, We Got It From Here, Thank You For Your Service, was released in November 2016, several months after the passing of Fife Dawg. Do you think that this album is a fitting swan song for A Tribe Called Quest?
It is. I mean, I think it's definitely more fitting than The Love Movement was, which came out in 98. You know, and I think it's an album that is very much sonically and emotionally situated in the time it was released in. It was released the week of the after the election.
Yeah.
Or the week of the election.
Yeah.
Come on, let's make it. Gotta make it.
To make it.
To make it.
To make it.
To make something happen.
To make something happen.
To make something happen. Let's make something happen. Word to fight for gonna bring it to the overlord.
And it balances grief and anger really well.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it is kind of an album that has adult concerns. It's made by an adult group.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's really important.
Do you have a favorite song on the album?
Black Spasmodic is my favorite song on that album, I think, because it has a fife verse that I think is one of the great fife verses.
Now who won it with the Trini Gladiator? Mid finger to you haters, you bodies not innovators. I take zero for granted, I honest my gift. Champion petting game, plus I'm freestyling quick. You clowns be bum sauce, speak my name is curtains.
In the acknowledgments of your book, you thank A Tribe Called Quest for allowing a landscape for you to make sense of the troubled times in your past, in your present, and undoubtedly in your future. I found that a very powerful statement. Can you talk a bit about how A Tribe Called Quest has helped you to make sense of the troubled times in your life?
Yeah, I mean, I think just the act of layering a sample, for example, is to place some beauty on top of already existing beauty, reaching for a single kind of better horizon than the one that's already there. I think about that often. That's a metaphor, I think, for my attempts to get through difficulty. But also, you know, I appreciate that in some ways both of them, Q-Tip and Fife, were just cynical and honest, right? Which I think, you know, sometimes I'm not looking to get through difficulty. I'm looking for new ways to be honest about it. And I think that's something that's shown through in their work.
See, you left your work at home, so they pat you down for nothing. Why in the hell does 10-4 keep fronting? You push through the park, even though it's still dark. The kid is nice on the hoop. He said, I spot you, truth. The night is on my mind. Sun is still shining.
How has A Tribe Called Quest influenced you as a poet and a writer?
I think experimentation and invention and being fearless in both of those pursuits. You know, not fearless so much so that I don't believe in failure, but fearless in understanding that, one, I'm not the first to attempt something, and so it's okay that something's been done before, but I have to attempt to find new ways to do it in my own voice.
Hanif Abdur-Aqib is the author of Go Ahead in the Rain, Notes to A Tribe Called Quest. You can find out more about Hanif and A Tribe Called Quest at wpr.org/beta.
Also, I was very intrigued in the idea that Game of Thrones is coming to an end. So it had like an emotional destination, and I could really feel that all season long. There was a lot of people taking a moment to sort of think about, oh my goodness, well, what does this mean?
Filmmaker Jeannie Finley talks about her documentary Game of Thrones, The Last Watch. That's coming up next. You're listening to Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon, and you're listening to Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Set and action! And the dragons pass over you. And off they go, and they bank left. They get further and further away, that light slowly disappearing, and now there are none. But what you can hear is a very, very low rumble.
The fantasy phenomenon Game of Thrones has come to an end after 8 seasons. Filmmaker Jeannie Finley had the rare honor of documenting the final season. Embedded with the cast and crew, she gives us an up-close, intimate, behind-the-scenes look into all of the blood, sweat, and tears that went into the production. We caught up with Jeannie while she was in Belfast for a film fest, where she told us how she landed this once-in-a-lifetime job. And spoiler alert, we do reveal the ending of Game of Thrones during our conversation.
I got a mysterious email from an Irish producer just saying HBO are going to be in touch tomorrow. Take the call. So it was very mysterious and intriguing. So I took the call and it was 3 people from Game of Thrones. I sort of Googled them and I was like, well, it's something to do with Game of Thrones. I wonder what this is about. And so I just chatted to them about how I would make a documentary. You know, I've made 6 feature, at that point I'd made 6 feature documentaries, I've now made 8. And I just told them how I would approach a subject matter. You know, I'm not always the biggest, you know, I wasn't like a walking encyclopedia of Game of Thrones as lots of people are, but it's such a sort of pop culture behemoth.
Oh, yeah.
You can't ignore the impact of Game of Thrones. So I was immediately sort of like, the intriguingness of it just immediately made my ears prick up and just think, what's this?
Yeah. So why do you think HBO picked you? They must have been impressed with your previous documentaries.
I think the thing was, the more I was myself and the more that I described my approach, you know, I'm into observing a situation and seeing what happens. And I'm into film. I'm really interested in like small moments. And I'm interested in not always the loudest characters. Like, I'm allergic to show-offs. So I'm very, very interested in people who may not have spoken on camera before. And I was really into this sort of idea of unsung heroes. And you think you know a world, but who are the cogs that are making this wheel turn? You know, and also I was very intrigued in the idea that Game of Thrones is coming to an end. So it had like an emotional destination, and I could really feel that all season long. There was a lot of people taking a moment to sort of think about, oh my goodness, well, what does this mean?
My heart is in my throat when I think about this not happening much longer. Putting this on, it genuinely gets me really like, oh.
You spent most of the last watch following producers and crew members making the magic of Game of Thrones happen, and we get a good sense of the dedication to craft and the incredible attention to detail. Why did you choose to take this approach?
Game of Thrones already has a really well-established behind-the-scenes team that follow every single episode. And so their approach is big cameras, sit-down interviews with questions that are written, you know, 2 weeks before the interview. And my approach was, can we find some people that you've not met before and get to know them over a season?
Right.
You know, there's a crew of 2,000 people making Game of Thrones, so it seemed important to me that we had some of the cast in it, but that it wouldn't always be focused on cast. It was, for me, it was really important that everyone really earned their place, so they had to have an unfurling story. So it seemed really obvious to me that Kit and Emilia would be in my film because they crossed over with Candice and what she was doing in the hair department. And also Andrew McClay's story hinges on his favourite character, Jon Snow. So it made narrative sense. I tried not to get too distracted by fan service.
Yeah.
And to just treat this like I would any other documentary that I make. Everything has to earn its place.
Right. Your approach makes perfect sense. It's in keeping with your philosophy of small stories. And as you mentioned, Andrew McClay, who plays one of the Stark guards, and he ends up being one of the stars of your film. How did he become such a big part of the film?
Well, you see me meeting him on camera.
If you said come in a bit later on, there's a guy called Andrew McClay who has been a Stark guard every single year, and he's obsessed with the whole show. And yeah, I think it'd be really cool if you just got to meet him. We'd be so excited.
Hey, what?
Hi, man.
Are you Andrew?
I am.
You're the person I'm here to see. I'm Jeannie. I'm making a documentary about Game of Thrones.
Okay.
For a whole year.
Okay.
I was wondering if I could please follow your fitting.
Excellent.
It was really important to me that we sort of reveal the shaky camera of me sort of meeting him, because it was that immediate. And when I met him, it's like falling in love. You know, sometimes I'm looking, I don't want to say casting, but I spent the first four to 6 months of the filmmaking really thinking about who was going to be on camera, who are we going to meet in the film. And yeah, when I met Andrew, it was just absolutely immediate. He's funny and charismatic.
Very much
so,
yeah.
An amazing face.
Yeah, exactly.
And he's so funny. He's just genuinely brilliant to be around.
Do you know what club sandwich means? Chicken and lettuce under bacon. That's what that is. I didn't know
chicken
that.
Chicken and lettuce, oh, it's an acronym.
Yeah, chicken and lettuce under bacon.
You learn something
every day. Boom, every day's a school day, brother.
Rolling!
And a lot of people are very used to seeing the grand scale and what they're doing. They take it in their stride. And the good thing about Andy was he never took it in his stride.
Yeah.
In a really charming and delightful way.
Yeah, exactly. Very well said indeed. Yeah. You caught some incredibly intimate moments with the actors, perhaps none more powerful than when actor Kit Harington, who plays Jon Snow, finds out the ending of the show in real time during a table read. What was your experience in dealing with the actors like?
It was really fascinating watching Kit experiencing that in real time. I'd got a heads up that he hadn't read it. And so I was like, oh, hello, this is going to be great.
We see John with his hand still on the hilt of the dagger he just lodged in Danny's heart. Her strength leaves her and she collapses to the marble. He keeps her in his arms and she falls, kneeling down to the floor beside her. He looks down at what he's done, terrible and necessary. End of Game of Thrones.
And for a while, I wasn't going to be able to film the table read. And there was some discussion about, oh, it's not possible. We can't do this. So I sat down with David and Dan and I just sort of said, I'm not going to ask you for a lot. Mm-hmm. But when I do come and ask you for stuff, you need to listen. And I said, you've got to let me film the table read. You have to. Just mm-hmm. trust me. It'll be great.
Yeah.
So we sort of agreed that I wouldn't roam around too much. I wouldn't distract people. It was wild sort of filming it because I was filming Conleth and Amelia. So that was my side. And then my cameraman Mark was filming Kit. So I was too nervous to capture Kit properly. So I made Mark film that side. And then as people relaxed, we just sort of wandered around and saw stuff. And I think it was the first time that everyone really realize that it's going to finish, because when I think Dan says end of Game of Thrones, there was this really emotional atmosphere of, oh my goodness, it is going to end.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to finish.
Mm-hmm.
It just sort of really occurred to me, oh my goodness, what is it like to hear that you've died? The character that you've known and loved for almost 10 years, what does that feel like? So I wanted to sort of linger on those moments. To me, there's been a lot of discussion online that, oh, it's about anger and reaction to the writing. To me, in the room, it felt very different to that. It felt like sadness of saying goodbye to part of yourself. It felt like grieving.
Yeah. Yeah, that's how it comes across. Yeah, it's a very powerful scene in the film. Do you have a favorite scene or moment in the film? Is it the table read or is it something else?
The table read, I think, is great. Mm-hmm. It's exciting and I was glad we got it. But I sort of figured I knew how that might turn out when we were filming it.
Mm-hmm.
I was more... I love, like, Kit wearing his extras jacket and just seeing how excited Andrew McClay was, because it's all unpredictable. And I think the best things in a documentary are when things sort of take you by surprise and you feel like you're watching the finished film.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to say, when we were in Seville and we'd been filming with Kit going through that crowd of fans, and I found it quite overwhelming because I was in the back of the car filming Kit.
Mm-hmm.
And people were banging on the car.
When all the Spanish fans shout Kit, they shout Keith, Keith. So the rest of the cast have now dubbed me Keith.
Keith.
Keith, Keith.
Keith, 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 Keith. Hi, hi, Galón.
Venga, cuidado, papito.
Say something.
I just really got the sense that you can't turn fame off. And I love Vlad the Night King's story.
Oh, yeah.
Because he is this just humble, humble stuntman who's doing the work, who's a shadow in the background. And now he's the most visible villain in the world, yet people still don't know him. And that, to me, is delicious. That's a delicious story.
I would like to see if they recognize who I am, you know? You know who I am?
Yeah!
You know, Vlad's really humble. So him sort of saying, shall we go and see if they recognize me?
Mm-hmm.
And he's quite mischievous.
Yeah.
And you can see it running through his mind like, oh my goodness, I wonder if they know who I am. Of course they know who he is. Yeah. He's the Night King. But he's so charming and then doesn't quite know what to do with himself because he's not practiced at doing that.
No.
For me, that was just, it was so perfect.
Yeah, that was definitely one of the highlights of the film. What were your thoughts on the way the final season played out, given your unique perspective of being around for its production?
It's weird for me, really, because I still feel too close to it. Mm-hmm. So since the final season went out, obviously my film broadcast a week after. So, you know, I watched the final episode in my hotel room with Alice Powell, who edited my film, and Hannah Peel, who scored my film. So we watched it together, but we're sort of watching it, I don't know, it sort of feels like we're watching home movies. You know, we're cheering when Andy gets a close-up and looking out for my daughter because she was a wildling extra in the final scene. So I was just sort of watching it for that. So I feel like I've got no distance from it at all. So I'm fantasizing about going on holiday and I'm going to watch the final season again and just to sort of watch it properly, really.
Yeah, you mentioned that your documentary premiered a week after the series finale. Were you worried at all that the show's kind of lost momentum in terms of the controversy about the ending of the series, that would impact the reception of your documentary?
I mean, I would be lying if I said no.
Mm-hmm.
I'd been watching, I'm really into memes, so I'd be looking at a lot of
Oh, yeah, and there's a Game of memes. Thrones. It's like there's a whole Game of Thrones meme industrial complex, yes.
Oh, it's amazing. So yeah. I was watching a lot of memes, but a lot of them were so mean about the showrunners.
Yeah.
And a lot of really unrealistic expectations. Oh, they should have done it in so many extra episodes. Are you kidding me? Do you know how much an episode costs?
Yeah.
There was a lot of unrealistic things and people complaining about Ghost wasn't petted and then he gets a pet in the final season. Mm-hmm. I read some stuff that fans were saying, oh, they responded to fan outcry. It's like, are you kidding? Do you know the months of work it does to have a direwolf doing anything?
Yeah.
So anyway, yeah. So I was petrified, mm-hmm. I've got to say. And we'd had a public screening in a cinema in Belfast. And then it was airing worldwide. So I sat up with my husband and I sort of said, we should watch this because we'll never get this back. It's going out in 180 countries.
Yeah.
And but I said, I'm not looking. So he looked at the internet, he looked at Twitter. And then people started making memes of my film and it just felt like the ultimate validation.
So with that is a Game of Thrones rap and our good friend, Jacob Anderson, Liam Cunningham and Kit Harington.
Near the end of The Last Watch, the question of what it was like for the cast and crew of Game of Thrones to say goodbye to the show comes up. What do you think the answer is? What sense did you get, like, based on the footage you got and observing all this? How did they feel? It seemed to me like that was going to kind of be an identity crisis, losing a big part of their life not to have this be involved in this show anymore.
I think it's challenging. I was, Vladimir came to Sheffield Documentary Festival a couple of days ago. And we were all at dinner and we were sort of talking about what it's like to end. And he said, you know, you have to have a ball to catch. He said, sometimes when you're in the thick of it, you just think, I want this to end. I never want to do it again. But he said, give it a month. And then you're like, what's the next job? What am I doing next? And you have to be able, you have to have something that's outside of your life, outside of filming. You know, and I appreciate that as a filmmaker. You've got to have other interests and be able to do stuff. I was really touched when I was filming Amelia on her last day. And I think she was really generous with allowing us to see her quite so vulnerable. She'd never allowed anyone to even photograph her with her bald cap on before.
I'm not sure this wig's got much more life left in it.
Neither is the front. Neither is the head underneath it, so. Oh, it's the last time.
That's the last time.
Oh, that's really weird.
And those moments of quiet when she's just sort of saying, you know, who am I without this? I wonder. And I just sort of felt like, yeah, I wonder too. And I think it will take a while for them all to land. But yeah, imagine playing, you know, one of the most iconic, famous roles in the world. What next?
Jeannie Finley is a documentary filmmaker and the director of Game of Thrones, The Last Watch. You can find out more about Jeannie at wpr.org/beta. That does it for this edition of Beta. Thanks to our guests, Raphael Bob Waxberg, Hanif Abdurraqib, and Jeannie Finley. If you want to hear this episode again or binge on past episodes, subscribe to the Beta Podcast via iTunes or wherever you catch your favorite pods. You can keep up with us during the week online at wpr.org/beta or on Twitter at @WPRBeta. Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Beat Productions.
That's just flavor to a high life man.
Special thanks to producer Brad Kohlberg.
If this was a real thing, why would Brad call you and not me?
Our music and technical director is Steve Gotcher.
That went slightly better than the worst it could have possibly gone, so hooray.
Our executive producer is Adam Friedrich.
I'm a Ryan Seacrest type.
And thanks to you, our Alvis. Until next week, I'm Doug Gordon.
Is it just me or am I nailing this interview? I kind of feel like I'm nailing it.